You are listening to Proof Text, a Glossa House podcast exploring scripture and all things related to it. New episodes are released daily. For more information, check out glossahouse.com and subscribe to our channels on Spotify and YouTube. Welcome and enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Proof Text. I'm Michael Halcombe and I am here today with Dr. John Walton. He is an esteemed scholar, professor of Old Testament emeritus at Wheaton College. Dr. Walton, it's great to have you on the podcast today. We're excited to hear from you. And so as I'm going to put your page from wheaton.edu up on the screen for just a moment so folks can see that themselves. It's very impressive. And I was reading back through this again today, and I enjoyed reading your story of how, you know, you were raised in a Christian home, and your wife is very scholarly. Your children are what you call an academically intense group, and you have some fun dinner discussions. And so tell us, if you would, as we get started here, just a little bit more about you know, what it was like. Where did you grow up? And tell us a little bit more about your background.
I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And went to public school, but was trained in the Bible, both at my home and in my church. And it's interesting, the church we attended, I met in a barn. But the barn was surrounded by a housing development. The farmer had sold off his fields and a developer had built houses. So we're in the middle of a suburban development, but the barn was still sitting there. And our little church used that barn as a meeting place. So my Sunday school rooms were like animal stalls with the half walls and the straw on the floor. It wasn't used as a barn anymore. I mean, as a, you know, place for animals anymore. But those were my Sunday school rooms and a very interesting church experience growing up.
Yeah, wow. So growing up, you said Philadelphia, did you have much interaction with the Amish community? Or
no, not really. Again, in the place, in the area where we grew up, there weren't many Amish around, although my parents eventually retired to Lancaster County, and we had plenty of interaction in the sense of seeing them riding around in their buggies.
Yeah, wow. You said you were, I loved how you worded it, you were trained in the Bible at home. What did that look like? What would, you know, family Bible time look like? Was that mom and dad, mom mainly, or dad mainly, or how did that work?
You know, I don't really recall a lot of regular family devotions. It was just stuff we talked about all the time. I had, was one of five siblings, and we just talked about the Bible and theology a lot. Not because we had scheduled times, it just was part of our home life.
Wow. Wow, interesting. And you were one of five siblings. You've gone on to become a very prominent Old Testament scholar. Did your other siblings, did they stick with the faith? Did they move into anything vocational similar to biblical studies, or did they all go different routes?
My older brother taught in a Christian high school for his entire career, 45 years or so in the same Christian high school. So he went into that area. My brother, just younger than me, served as a youth pastor for most of his career and enjoyed interacting with youth. And in his in more recent days, set up a website to be kind of an online youth pastor to try to help students deal with their questions. So
interesting. Wow. Well, yeah. Thanks for sharing some of that. So obviously, in your bio, you talk about you taught at Moody Bible for a couple decades before going to Wheaton, and you've written extensively. I mean, among the more than a dozen books that I own, ancient Near Eastern thoughts, demons and spirits, how to read Job, a lot on Genesis. You've really bedded down there, the IVP Bible background commentary. And you have this running series going, The Lost World. And you have The Lost World of Adam and Eve, The Lost World of Genesis 1, The Lost World of Scripture, Lost World of the Flood, Lost World of the Israelite, Lost World of the Torah. How did this notion of the Lost World come about?
Well, that's an interesting story. I had this understanding of Genesis 1 that I had developed, and I wanted to write it up. And so I contracted with IVP to put that in a hopefully accessible, easily communicated format. And I had just titled it something very functional, you know, Interpreting Genesis 1 or something. And there, after they had their company discussion about title, you know, with their marketing and salespeople and their editorial people, they said, well, we think that it should be titled The Lost World of Genesis 1. So it was their idea. And I confess that at first I was reluctant. I said, oh, I don't know. You know, these were the days of Jurassic Park. I said, you know, people are going to think of dinosaurs and that's not what this is about. And I don't know. And they just said, trust us, we think it'll work. So I said, okay. I mean, that's what you get paid for. So we called it The Lost World of Genesis 1. And of course, it ended up working very well. It drew people into the idea. But we never anticipated that it would be a series. As a matter of fact, every one that I've written, I've said, oh, this is the last Lost World book I'm going to do. And then something else comes up and I write another one. And number 7 just came out and number 8 is at the publisher. And that's the Lost Lost World book I'm going to, well, we'll see.
Wow. That's fascinating how that works out. So obviously it is a really creative series title and, you know, this whole Lost World idea. Living here in Hawaii, I live just a few miles away from where they film a lot of that Jurassic Park stuff. And, so that's interesting to hear about. So the creation story, I mean, a lot of people obviously are interested in this. And in some of our email correspondence, I had mentioned this BioLogos article that you had written some time ago titled On Being Right or Wrong. And I was reading back through that again today. And, you know, you're talking about the creation story. And if you would, just in case sort of some of my listeners or viewers might not be familiar with your perspective, though I know quite a few probably are, in a nutshell, could you give us an idea of an overview and of what your view would be on sort of the creation narrative? Like, could you give us that just in a nutshell?
Sure. It's based on the premise that we want to make sure we understand the words well, the Hebrew words well, and that we understand the culture from which it's coming. It all comes to bear on asking the question, what kind of creation account is this? Because there could be many different kinds of creation accounts, all true from the perspective that they're offered. And so my goal is to try to understand how an Israelite reader would have understood this creation account. So again, a quick illustration. If you're going to the theater and you somehow, for whatever reasons, got there late and intermission came and you turned to the people around and said, how did the play begin? One person might talk about the script and you'd say, oh, no, that's not what I'm interested in. He says, well, you can't have a play without a script. Well, I get that. And another person would talk about the set or the stage and you can't have a play without the stage. And another person might talk about the cast. And finally, you would have to clarify and say, no, I want to know what's happened since the curtain opened. And those are all of those answers would be right answers. They just would reflect a different perspective. And so it is with creation accounts. How did the world begin? What kind of information would somebody want? And you can tell that story many different ways, and they're all fine. It's not like they're false or contradictory. And so that was part of the Lost World of Genesis 1 premise, that we have to ask, what kind of creation account is this? We can't just assume that they're going to tell the same kind of account that we would in our modern scientific kinds of ways. So that's when I asked that question. So part of the book is to say, in the ancient world, when they talked about how did the world begin, they weren't asking a question about material origins. They were asking a question about God ordering the world. I called it functions, but order is a better term. God was ordering the world to function the way that he wanted it to. He was ordering it with a role and a purpose. And so I contend that that's the kind of creation story it is. How did the world begin? God brought it into order. And so it's a different kind of approach than what we would think of in our world. The other part of Genesis 1 is the question of rest. And we often are confused by day 7 because relaxation and sleeping and leisure doesn't seem to hit the target. But I bring out that in the ancient world, the gods rest in temples, and their rest is not on a bed, it's on a throne. They're ruling over the world that they have ordered. And so those two parts, the ordering and the idea of God ruling rather than relaxing, are the two major aspects of that book.
Very fascinating. I appreciate that. And so, so I'm from Kentucky originally, and I grew up with in Grant County, Kentucky. And so the new ARC project is right in the backyard of where I grew up. And in fact, when I was a young minister, just fresh out of Bible college, that's when the Creation Museum opened up. And I remember Ken Ham inviting all the local pastors in Kentucky and Cincinnati to come sort of get a preview of coming attractions. And I find that very interesting, the way that you're explaining that. It has a very different starting point, doesn't it, than maybe where they're starting from. Nevertheless, like going back to that BioLogos article you wrote on being right or wrong, part of the thing that you're sort of suggesting there is that, yeah, there's a difference in perhaps starting points, but you know, there's also we have these underlying presuppositions, but when we hold to this idea of inessentials unity, that allows us to discourse with one another and discourse fruitfully. So I'm wondering, I mean, you're in Chicago now. Are you still in Chicago?
Yep.
Yeah, so you're not too far from Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, where I know that creationism and looking at the world from the origins of the world from that perspective are still very much in play, you know, and very much part of the conversation. I'm wondering, what have your interactions been since you've published your views with people who hold to a firm or strict creationist perspective?
Well, I was raised in a young earth context, so I understand it very well. Even into my early days in teaching, I would still have defined myself in that way. So it's I'm not looking at that just as an outsider.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I understand that their concern is the integrity of the Bible.
Yeah.
I get it. I share that concern. And so in that sense, I'm not critical of them. I commend their desire to defend the integrity of Scripture, because that's what I was doing when I took that view. They believe that they're reading the text literally, and they are, if you assume a modern sense of the words. I would contend that I am reading it literally, but I am assuming an ancient sense of the words. In other words, I'm not making it metaphorical or symbolic. I'm trying to understand it the way that the writers would have understood it as best I can. And so I'm trying to get in touch with that ancient world, and they don't think that that's necessary. So it's really a difference in an interpretive method that's involved. The reason I like to steer away from right and wrong, of course, we all like to be right. I'd love to be right. I hope that on many things that I'm right. But the fact is, I've changed my mind on some things, right, which means that there are things that I used to think I was right on that I don't think are right anymore. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, certainly we all have landed in places that we believe are right. But the fact that we can sometimes change our minds tells me that what I should be more interested in is being as faithful as I can be with the information that I have. Yeah. So I tend to try to think in terms of being faithful instead of being right. And so in that sense, they're trying to do the same thing.
Right.
They're trying to be faithful to Scripture. And like I said, I commend that. I admire it. I want them. I certainly don't want to tell them, don't be faithful to Scripture.
Right.
But yet there are people in that camp who, like me, have found reasons to start to feel uncomfortable there. Mm. For my last years as a young earth person, I described myself as an uncomfortable young earth person because it felt like there were some things that weren't fitting. And there are people out there like that that still hold to a young earth because they don't know how else to be faithful to Scripture. And some of them, when they read my work, say, there's a way. That's a direction. That's still being faithful to Scripture, but it's not coming to the same conclusions.
Right.
And so some people respond to my work very favorably. Of course, there are other people who resist, and I get it. It's a tough jump to make.
Yeah.
But my job is not to make everybody agree with me. My job is to put information on the table that people might not know, and it might help them. And right. If they find that useful, that's great. If they don't, fine. You know, I'm doing my job.
So you've recently put out a book titled Wisdom for Faithful Reading, Principles and Practices for Old Testament Interpretation. So I love that title, Wisdom for Faithful Reading. And it sounds a lot like what you're touching on just a moment ago, that, you know, I put that on the table and my aim is to be faithful in regards to the data that's in front of me and what I know. And can you say a little bit more about that particular volume, Wisdom for Faithful Reading?
Sure. It came together in a fairly interesting way. Over the years of teaching freshmen and sophomores Old Testament, just introduction to Old Testament, for many of them, they had never had anything like it. And so trying to help them to understand not just the Old Testament content, but what do we do with the Old Testament? And I think lots of Christians struggle right. with that. What do we do with it? It's, you can memorize the whole Old Testament. You could know all the trivia that there is, but that still wouldn't mean you knew what to do with it. Mm. And so over the years, I developed little phrases, which I called sound bites, which were designed to try to help students kind of think about the Old Testament in particular ways. And of course, some of them have become fairly famous, like my saying that the Bible is not written to us, but it's written for us. Mm-hmm. And lots of people use that. And so just a little soundbite that I would unpack. Well, over time, I collected about 30 or 35 of these little soundbites. And so what I did was just put them together in a book.
Excellent.
So it doesn't make it a comprehensive book on interpretation, but it highlights all kinds of little bits and pieces of interpretation that I hope people will find helpful, because a lot of people want to be faithful readers of Scripture.
Yes. Another book you wrote was the NIV Cultural Background Study Bible with Craig Keener. It's a massive volume. I wonder, what was that like working through that process? I mean, that's a massive undertaking. What was that process like?
Sure. Well, that Bible, all the study notes are cultural background study notes. So we don't do application, we don't do theology, we don't do just kind of the common comments that study Bibles right. make. That's all great. But this one, all of them are focused on cultural background. if I had had to do that from scratch, it would have been a much more difficult process. But as it was, before that came out, I'd already done the IVP Bible Backgrounds Commentary on the Old Testament, and I had also done the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary on the Old Testament, 5 volumes. And so I was able to just use the information from those two sources to compile the study Bible. I also wrote some new stuff for it, keep things up to date and, you know, new information, new perspectives. But for the most part, it was condensed, distilled from those two sources.
Wow. You'd mentioned too, when I was reading your short bio there on the Wheaton site, that it was in the year that you read a book called you were taking a class called Archaeology and Bible History, and that sort of launched you into being an Old Testament scholar. And in our email correspondence, you're saying that one of your sons, do you have multiple children or just
one? Mm-hmm. Three kids.
One of your children is an archaeologist. That's pretty interesting. Have you called them an academic and academically intense group. Are they working in Bible studies as well? Like, is it just him or?
Well, my oldest son, John, got his PhD in biblical theology from St. Andrews, and I've done 3 books with him. You've got the titles there in front of you. 2 of them are Lost World books. So that's my oldest son. He's a theologian, and currently he's looking for a good academic position because he just finished his PhD recently. My second son is the archaeologist. He's been doing archaeology since he was 17 years old, so that's over 20 years now. And he goes over every summer, digs in Israel. He has his PhD in archaeology, and he teaches at the University of Maine. So they're the two that are in academia. My daughter, my third child, is a metadata librarian. And so she does cataloging and those sorts of things.
Interesting. What's that been like to work with your children on writing books? I mean, that's pretty unique. Most Bible scholars or scholars in general don't have that opportunity. What's that been like?
It's been very rewarding, very challenging, just because they stretch me. They aren't afraid to challenge what I say, to say, you know, Dad, I'm not sure that you can get away with saying that. And I might say, well, I've said it for many years. And they say, well, you know, your hermeneutics can't get you there. You should try to reevaluate. So, you know, we have interesting conversation. And so it's a very, very interesting process that I enjoy very much.
Yeah. And you had noted one of the other things that stuck out to me on this bio page is you said, you've taught high school Bible studies, adult ed classes, intro to doctrine for 6th graders, and Bible stories to 4-year-olds. And so this is the entire gamut of at least in terms of ages. What is needed? What kind of a skill set is needed to be able to sort of, I don't know, interact and engage with such a wide age range? I mean, you go from telling Bible stories to 4th graders to working with post-grad students. That takes a certain kind of, a certain skill set.
Well, your research and thinking and preparation have to be up to the task of your highest audience. And so that, for me, of course, is an academic audience, PhD students, colleagues in the field, as well as students in graduate kind of courses. Your preparation has to be up to that. But your communication has to be up to then not dumbing it down, but making it communicative to younger audiences. And that's what it does. It really stretches your ability to communicate important ideas in the forms that other audiences can receive it. Right. And so you always have to be aware of your audience, what they can receive and what they can't, and trying to make sure that you can configure your ideas in that kind of setting.
Right, right. Are you still teaching these days?
Interested in growing your ancient language skills but not sure where to start? Glossa House can help. From illustrated readers and short stories to lexicons and grammars, Glossa House offers a variety of resources for beginning, intermediate, and experienced ancient language learners. Head to glossahouse.com today. Glossa House, language resources for the global community.